This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today marks 38 years since the first Earth Day and 1 year since NPR, in partnership with National Geographic, inaugurated a series called Climate Connections.
Carbon trading is super sexy.
Yeah, it is quite an exciting discovery.
It's just miles of seas around and it's closing. We are going to be homeless.
The countries are already facing a lot of problems in climate change. Coming on top of it would certainly put them in a more precarious situation.
Over this past year, we've taken you around the world, to melting glaciers in Greenland, to the Prime Meridian in Greenwich, England, to the Amazon rainforest, the Pacific Islands of Fiji, and to Timbuktu, to look at how people change climate and how climate changes people. The series incorporated more than 200 stories from more than 50 nations and contributions from more than 100 reporters, editors, and producers. We'll talk with two of them in just a moment. If you have questions about the project or if you have a story about your experience with the effects of global warming, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And you can also join the conversation on our blog. That's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we'll spend a year on the road to learn about the strange life of a Rolling Stones tribute band. But first, Climate Connections. NPR science correspondents Richard Harris and Chris Joyce join us here in Studio 3A, and welcome to you both.
Pleased to be here.
Likewise.
And Richard, what in terms of science, what have we learned about global warming in the past year?
Well, I think the biggest landmark really was a little bit before our series started, which was the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, a big UN panel that came on and said, you know, this is for real, absolutely. They got rid of a lot of their their wiggle words from previous reports and said, you know, it really appears that human beings are changing the climate. This is serious. This looks bad. This looks serious. And it's going to be really, really hard to do something about it. But not impossible.
Mm-hmm. And well, besides that, well, big picture thing, the snapshots you took, I remember hearing you next to a glacier, I think it was in Iceland, and going up with people who measure this glacier every year. And this year it had melted faster than ever before.
Yeah, faster than a long time, and they've been going there for decades and decades. So, yes, it is everywhere we went and looked. Once you sort of start looking at things through the lens of climate change, you really can see things very differently. And that's, I think, was my experience, and talking to my colleagues, the experience of my colleagues as well.
Mm-hmm. And Chris Joyce, I know that one of the things that you focused on was on technologies and how they are being adapted. And we heard just a little clip in that montage about carbon trading, mm-hmm. Not only carbon trading, but carbon burying.
Carbon burying, carbon trading, I would call it the 21st century being the carbon century, perhaps, because, and I won't attribute it to NPR's coverage, but there's been a tremendous increase in the amount of attention given to the subject. And part of it was Al Gore's movie, but I think this, in general, people are paying a lot more attention to it. The science is becoming somewhat clearer. And there's also a tremendous business that's sort of rising up out of the whole issue, and people are starting to make money on it, not only in the design of new technology to deal with carbon, but in sort of the mid layer of people who are making money trading carbon credits and trying to invest to get people to invest in green forms of energy that are now beginning to replace. Perhaps not as fast as they could.
Well, among the technologies that are becoming clearer, there's this idea that you can, well, bury some deposits to get rid of them. And in the North Sea, you encountered one story with, a bit of irony, too.
The Norwegians are burying CO2, and it's the longest standing experiment. I guess it's beyond the experimental stage. For over 10 years, it's an oil and gas platform that's out in the North Sea, the Sleipner platform. And they extract with their natural gas, they extract the CO2 from that, and they bury it back in beneath the seabed in something called the Utsira Formation, which is an aquifer underneath the sea. And they find that it's successful. It stays down there. They're able to measure it and prove that it stays down there. And, in fact, they're getting interest from people in Europe saying, hey, this is like a big bank. Can we send you some of our CO2?
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, they're using that CO2 to force out more oil.
Well, not exactly at Sleipner, but that is a use for the CO2 that is extracted from oil and gas. You can put it back. And that's happening in the United States as well. It's one of the more popular ideas of what to do with CO2 once you extract it.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I wanted to play a clip from one of your stories. This was from your visit to Greenland and going out to, well, another melting glacier. It turns out there are a lot of melting
yes.
glaciers, not just in Iceland. But on this one, you were wondering where the water went when it melted on the surface of the glacier. And, well, let's take a listen.
I don't know where the water is going, but my guess is that it's going to the bottom of the ice sheet. Right before it disappears from view, it takes some huge jumps down. And as far as we've dared to creep to the edge and look down, you just see it cascading almost 45 degrees or even steeper downwards into the ice with this thundering roar.
Okay. I am not going to get too close to the edge. I am very nervous being right this close to a hole that's about 3,000 feet deep. I am going to try an experiment, which is I have a mic on a 40-foot-long cable, and I'm going to try to toss the mic over the edge to get a better sound. So here goes.
And there went more water in an hour than Los Angeles uses in an hour.
Yes, it was. Of course, it doesn't run all year, but during the time it was running, we did an experiment. I actually helped the scientist. That was the voice of Sarah Doss from the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. And I helped the scientist do an experiment to figure out how fast water was flowing and how much of it was. And yes, indeed, it was just a tremendous amount of water, enough to feed Los Angeles, at least for the couple of weeks that this stream was running, river was running across the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. It was really dramatic. And in fact, when the water does get to the bottom of the glaciers, it makes the glaciers flow a little bit faster toward the sea. And that's what they were trying to figure out, because if the glaciers start flowing a lot faster, then Greenland could really be providing a lot more ice into the ocean and rise sea levels. And they were concerned about that. It turns out, on further analysis of their data, that it's not a very dramatic effect, but it will certainly contribute something to global sea level rise.
Mm-hmm. And Chris Joyce, I want to take you on revisit one of your adventures, too. Sure. You went to New Zealand, where, of course, they have a gas problem, which is produced. it's not man-made. It's animal-made. And you managed to debunk one of the great myths of all time.
And that methane then is either burped out or it gets absorbed into the bloodstream and then breathed out through the lungs.
So we should establish it's not cow farts.
It's a lovely headline, but I'm afraid it's biologically incorrect.
It's not cow. What have we been thinking all this time, Chris Joyce?
Well, methane, that was the voice of Harry Clark with an organization called Ag Research. And New Zealand does have a methane problem. And they are, in fact, the largest source of their greenhouse gases is their livestock. And they're trying to do something about it. You might think it's impossible, but actually you can alter the amount of methane that comes out of a cow's mouth. We've established that now. By changing what it eats, and what they're trying to do is understand the bacteria that are doing this in the cow's rumen, alter the bacteria, possibly genetically alter them, or at least change the way that how the feed affects the microbial mix in there, and essentially get cows to stop contributing to global warming, and then the New Zealanders would like to sell this to the rest of the world and get rich.
We're speaking with NPR science correspondents Chris Joyce and Richard Harris about their parts in, well, the many players who played a role in Climate Connections, which was a year-long project with NPR and National Geographic. If you'd like to join the conversation and tell us about your experiences with global warming, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Let's begin with Stephen. Stephen calling us from Jackson, Wyoming.
Yes, hi. I have a couple comments regarding my personal experience with global warming, specifically on a couple mountains, Kilimanjaro. I was there in 1997 snowboarding and ice climbing, and when I went back in 2003, I mean, literally like almost 1,000 feet of the glacier had disappeared in that time period. And what it's doing to us as ice climbers is limiting places that we're able to go internationally. And it's not only, you know, in Africa and equatorial areas that it's affecting, that's most marked, but really here in the Tetons and the Wind Rivers and pretty much throughout the world we're experiencing this. And it's changing ice climbs to mixed climbs, much thinner, more technical, and then where there were mixed climbs, it's changing into rock climbs, and sometimes that doesn't work if the rock quality is very poor. So it's really changing the face of climbing around the world. in different ways.
I don't think, Richard, you went to Kilimanjaro, but I know you talked with a family who had.
Yes, well, I actually was in Kilimanjaro, but not for the Climate Connection series. And Kilimanjaro actually turns out to be a complicated story. It's true that it's losing ice. It's been losing ice for well over a century, and there it's actually controversial about how much of that is climate change on Kilimanjaro. Clearly, globally, there's no question that the loss of ice on mountain glaciers is due to climate change, at least to some extent, and is a serious issue. But Kilimanjaro is a little bit, it was sort of a poster child for global warming and climate change, but there is actually some scientific back and forth about to what extent that really is human-induced.
Chris?
There's also, it might be worth noting that some of these glaciers are not just the source of for entertainment, but in Peru, for example, there are communities that depend on melting glaciers and the existence of the glacier for water supply, and these things are possibly endangered.
Hmm. Oh, definitely. I'm wondering, is that the case for Mount Kenya as well? Why specifically Kilimanjaro?
Richard?
Well, part of this has to do with rainfall patterns over the last century, and there have been shifts in rainfall patterns, and some of it's actually, Kilimanjaro doesn't usually get warm enough to melt per se, so what the question is how much of the ice is being replenished with new precipitation, and the answer is, over the last century, clearly not enough. And some of it does actually sublimate, which ice goes straight into gas form from ice and doesn't melt per se, but it's a bit of a complicated story on Kilimanjaro.
Stephen,
I've been there. When I was there, I mean, I saw significant melting occurring.
Oh, I don't think anybody's disputing the melting. It's the why is melting.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call, Stephen.
Yeah, I have one more comment regarding the livestock. And do you remember a while back there was something called Beano that you could add to your beans to prevent gas? Why don't they just use that for the livestock?
That'd be a lot of Beano.
That would be, but if it works, you know, why not go for it? Oh, thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Stephen. It's on this anniversary of Earth Day. We're marking it with a look back at NPR's series with National Geographic Climate Connections. And we're taking your calls about your experiences with global warming. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're looking back at Climate Connections this hour, NPR series about climate change created in partnership with National Geographic. If you'd like to listen to some of those 200 stories from 50 countries, you can find a year of reporting about the causes and signs of climate change, as well as solutions for fighting global warming at npr.org/climateconnections. We're talking with NPR science correspondents Richard Harris and Chris Joyce this hour. We want to hear from you. If you have direct experience with global warming and climate change, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also read what other listeners have to say at our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. And you both encountered some extraordinary people in your travels this past year to some of these amazing locations. In Navajo, Richard Harris, by the name of Charlie Chi.
Yes, indeed. We were we went out actually on a little camping expedition with some scientists who are studying what's happening with the what's happening in the Southwest and the prospect of permanent drought in the Southwest. And as in many stories within the climate, when we talked to some of the people who were there and whose lives were being affected by it, it was also clear that it was embedded in a much, much bigger story of cultural change as well. Obviously, the life of the Navajos has been changing a great deal in the last coming decades, and things change a lot. All of a sudden, you add another layer of change on it, and people say, "Gee, where's all this leading to? Where, you know, how is this additional change going to layer on top of all the cultural changes and other changes that that we've seen here?" And it's never something that I saw in isolation. It was always compounding changes in cultures. I mean, the world's changing a lot, and this is sometimes a very complicated thing to add on top of that.
And Chris Joyce, on a visit to the island of Kiribati in Fiji, you visited some people and found out how difficult it can sometimes be to convince citizens that climate change, even the climate change they can see as their island gets smaller and smaller, that it is happening and that it is man-made. Let's listen to this excerpt.
Papa, is sea level rising or is the island sinking? And the father's saying, don't worry about rising or sinking. You know God put Kiribati here. This is to test us if we believe man's word or God's.
I'm not sure I get it. I mean, what's the point here?
The Lord will provide, sort of thing. God will save us.
Is that an attitude that's prevalent in the Pacific?
Yes. Yes, very much so.
And does it make it difficult to convince people that actually the humans are making things different and we have to adapt?
To staunch Christians, yes.
So how do you convince them?
With as much data as possible. I mean, you can't argue with data.
That's Simon McGree, a meteorological office scientist in Fiji, and he's describing at the top of a cartoon that was in a newspaper. And the newspaper was with a father and son talking about climate change, and mm-hmm. Don't worry, God will take care. And I was quite intrigued and surprised, not knowing the Pacific that well, to find out, and through Simon and other people there, that there's a large fundamental Christian population there, and that he found it quite difficult to convince them that, look, you know, things are happening and we're not exactly sure how fast they're happening, but clearly they're going to happen, and we need to do something about it. And people were saying to him, don't, you know, it's all right, God will take care of us. Why should we do anything? And not universal, but he found that to be quite a difficult obstacle.
Let's get some callers in on this conversation. Again, 800-989-8255. And Julie's calling us from Michigan.
Hi there. Yes, that actually is exactly my question. My son's 12-year-old friend asked me, because everyone knows our family cares desperately about this issue, and he said, well, why do you want to stop global warming? We're happy it's coming because we think it's a good thing, because the Bible says that, you know, this is a sign that Jesus is coming, and I worry that we're missing out on a huge partnership with the Christian community here in our nation.
And maybe they ought to reemphasize that Noah story.
Mm-hmm. The flood.
Yeah. The flood, yeah. Noah.
Well, I think part of it is, the Christendom does not look at this in one way. I think there are some people who say, you know, we are the stewards of the earth and it's our responsibility to make sure that, to protect the earth.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, and other people say, well, you know, this is God's will and what happens, happens. So, I mean, it's not a monolithic response. Those are interesting and difficult questions.
There's an organization called the Alliance of Religions and Conservation. I was just over in England talking with them and their director, Martin Palmer. And he's an Anglican, a lay Anglican minister. And his take on it, he's working with 7 different religions, Shinto and Buddhist and Muslim. His argument is, look, you know, God created the planet and the earth, the universe, and we are, in a sense, responsible for what we do to it. And yes, we can thank the Lord for giving us what we have, but we can also say we're responsible for making sure we don't mess it up.
Julie?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Here's an email from Kurt in Renton, Washington. I thought that the Climate Connections paid remarkably little explicit attention to what I believe is the root cause of climate change and many other problems, this being population increase. It's a subject few seem to want to address. Perhaps this subject deserves its own series so the dots can be connected for a public that seems not to get it. Richard?
Well, I agree that's a serious issue, and I certainly encountered it when I was in Niger and talking to subsistence farmers who were concerned about what the climate was going to be like, but also aware that their population was growing, was doubling every 20 years, something like that, an incredibly high growth rate. And the village elders were aware that, you know, if they're barely making it each year, they have to keep improving and improving their crops every year just to feed the more and more mouths. And I think that was as much a root cause of what was going on in Niger as potential change in the climate as well. And they were at least aware of it. But I agree that it was not something we all often focused on in this series, but in poor parts of the world, a very, very important issue.
Let's go to Peggy. Peggy with us from Wilmington in North Carolina.
Hi. I was a 10-year-old during the first Earth Day, and I remember back in my teen years that the scientists were saying, you know, within our lifetime, things are really going to change unless we, you know, become responsible humans and make these environmental changes. And now, you know, many of those things have come to pass, and I'm wondering if we know how much reversed human impact we need to stop the climate changes.
Is it possible to stop the climate changes, Richard?
Well, it's not possible entirely because we've already committed to a certain degree of global warming. The uncomfortable facts are that you basically have to stop burning fossil fuels around the world, which is currently the basis of the global economy pretty much. But you basically have to bring emissions down at first to 50 or 80% below what they are now, and ultimately to zero. Otherwise, the climate will continue to warm and we will continue to have problems. Presumably, if you can get close to that, you will have much slower change, and maybe the slower change is more manageable than the faster change. But the science tells us, as best we can tell, that basically you have to bring these emissions down essentially to zero. And that is you know, that's something very, very hard to wrap your head around, how to do that.
Well, are emissions being reduced?
Practically nowhere. Even places in Europe that are talking, that have pledged to have significant cuts are still, Europe's last scorecard said European emissions are still going up. They're going up more or less here. We had a pleasant year in 2006, not too hot, not too cold, and that allowed us to basically hold our emissions steady or have them go down extremely slightly. But that was as a result of the weather, not because our behavior is particularly good.
Hmm. So does the scientific community then have kind of a realistic expectation or a goal of where we might be short-term, 10 to 20 years?
Well, maybe Chris can help me on this a little bit. I think realistic is a tough one. I think the scientists say, here's where you have to go, but then they sort of turn to the technologists right. And say, can you get us there? And that's a whole other question.
Well, scientists tend to, back away from the policy questions. Not all of them do, but in terms of what's going to happen in 10 or 20 years, a lot depends on what happens in the next election or two and what happens in Europe when they realize that the Kyoto Protocol that they've signed is not really doing the job. What's going to happen after 2012 when the Kyoto Protocol expires? And, there's a lot to be said for technology. The wind power is growing by leaps and bounds. People are spending lots of money on trying to figure out how to sequester, capture carbon out of coal, which is the biggest source of or source of power for electricity here in this country and in China, and bury it either under the sea or underground. If these things can be accomplished, and it will be very expensive to accomplish them, but if they can, then maybe we buy ourselves a few more years to make the transition to what Richard described as a non-fossil fuel economy.
Hmm. Thank you, Peggy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go now to Brian. Brian with us from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi. I was curious if researchers had considered the effects of global warming in regions that are already extremely hot, such as here in Arizona.
Yeah. Well, yes, hotter. I was. Yeah. It's going to get maybe a little bit hotter, but I think the bigger concern actually is water resources, particularly in your part of the world. There are a number of studies and models and forecasts that all point to the direction of less and less water for you guys out in the Southwest, and potentially a lot of difficulties with that, because obviously water is already fairly scarce. So we talk about global warming, but actually climate change might be the more appropriate term in this instance, because it's the rainfall that is going to really potentially be the biggest effect for you there. But yeah, I think places that are hot are likely to get somewhat hotter, and again, some places that are dry are likely to get drier. Some places that are dry might get wetter, too. It's not all bad news uniformly everywhere. But on the other hand, the net feeling is that things are going to get worse more often than they're going to get better.
One of the things that I found in South Pacific was they were thinking about sea level rise, and people live right at sea level. But the fact is that one of the things that they're feeling first is rainfall patterns are changing in the Pacific. And so many Pacific Islanders get their drinking water from rainwater. They don't have groundwater. So it could be that the first dire effects there won't be flooding. It'll be lack of water. Hmm.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much.
So long. Let's go now to Dave. Dave in La Crosse, Wisconsin.
Hello. Regarding the Greenland situation, when the Leif Erikson and Eric the Red came over in the 1300s, wasn't Greenland very... didn't they describe it as a place where they were able to grow crops and to live, and the climate was decent weather, and then they were eventually driven from Greenland because of the ice sheet?
Not quite, actually. I think Greenland, the name of it, was actually a marketing ploy to try to get people to go there. It was actually always, for hundreds of thousands of years, it's had a huge ice sheet in the middle of it and has not been very pleasant at all.
Iceland, though.
Iceland, well, Iceland's better, for sure. Iceland is much greener than Greenland, but really what we've seen is that there are also natural cycles in in global climate, and there were certainly warmer and more pleasant periods during which time the Vikings did expand into Iceland and then ultimately into Greenland, and then the weather turned bad and political times changed also in Europe, and they said, "Oops, this is really not working out well for us," and they did ultimately retreat and leave it. But it wasn't overwhelmingly because of the ice. It was, you know, they went out during a period of time when things were more pleasant than they are now, and then when things got nasty again, they withdrew.
But I do remember your story from Iceland, that it was a very forested, lush place when the Vikings arrived and proceeded to cut all the trees down.
That's right. When the Vikings arrived, it was almost entirely forested, and now it's essentially been denuded of forests, and there's now a big push in Iceland to try to grow some of these forests back, but it's like 3% trees now, when it was essentially very much more pleasant when the Vikings first arrived. And, of course, they exploited the land there the way the people who came to the United States first exploited the land here and chopped down a lot of the trees and really changed the environment of the Americas as well.
Dave, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking with NPR correspondents Richard Harris and Chris Joyce. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Matt on the air. Matt with us from Newark, Delaware.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for your guests, Richard and Chris. I was wondering if they could comment on the popular media-fueled myth or fear of rising sea levels due to the melting of the polar ice caps. And I was wondering if they could incorporate into their explanation the difference in densities of frozen water versus liquid water.
Sure. Well, there's two things going on here. One is when you have the ice that's floating on the Arctic Ocean, when it melts, it does not change sea level at all.
Ice cubes.
Way when you put ice cube in a glass of lemonade, when the ice cubes melt, the lemonade glass does not overflow. That's absolutely true. The rub comes, however, in the ice sheets near the South Pole in Antarctica, which are sitting on solid ground. And when that ice melts, it does add to global sea level. And there's plenty of ice in Antarctica and also in Greenland that's currently sitting on the ground. And that's the ice that people are worried about. I mean, there are other effects of having ice melt in the Arctic Ocean because it changes the reflectivity of the Earth, and it ends up, when you don't have so much ice, the Earth will absorb a lot more heat, and so it sort of is a positive feedback, if you will. But you're right, that does not affect global sea level, but the other ice, that's a different story because it's sitting on solid ground right now.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for making that distinction, and I was hoping in the future that the media will also be making that distinction.
We'll send them a memo.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Matt. Here's an email from Patrick in Minneapolis. How do you delineate between global warming caused by human action and long-term climate cycles that have flopped between ice ages and warming periods over millennia?
Well, you start looking at the ice cores and in the record of how much the atmosphere has changed in the past. I mean, you can determine from ice cores taken, especially from the Antarctic, but elsewhere, the natural variation over the past 10,000, 20,000, I think as far back as 800,000 years, you can get a signal of the oscillation that's part of the natural oscillation. And then you can look at more recent records and see that there has been this spike. Moreover, you can also simply measure the carbon and the other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and see that they're rising and know that, you know, when you have that in the atmosphere, it's going to heat up the atmosphere. That's the way it works.
Let's go to Vinny, and Vinny's calling us from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, yeah, so good to talk to you guys. Listen, I work outside at my own tree business. I've done snow removal. I had an argument with my friend years ago that I've gone from 42 snow removals in 85 to 36 to 32 to 33 to 30 to 29 till finally in the year 2000, I did about 8 or 11 snow removals. It just doesn't snow that much. Every summer it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. We've got trees and bugs and stuff getting into trees that I do beetle kill. I peeled off some bark a couple weeks ago, and there was larva in there because it hasn't gotten to 5 degrees or 10 below long enough to kill these bugs. And every time I hear somebody say, oh, well, by 2010 or 20, I don't think we've got till 2020 or 2010. Or it keeps getting worse every year, and you have these computer models. You're not calculating everything into computer models. Have you gone to the fire department and see how many fires are, you know, the CO2 from that? There's a whole bunch of little things I don't believe that they're putting in to these models to project what's happening. And that's why...
I don't mean to cut you off, Vinny, but...
The Weather Channel or something.
Vinny, I don't mean to cut you off. We've got to give Richard 20 seconds to respond to your remarks.
Yeah, well, I think that his remarks do point out that people really are seeing changes. We've always been thinking about this as something that's going to be for our kids and our grandkids and so on. But in fact, you can see evidence of it now.
Vinny, thanks very much. And again, I'm sorry for cutting you off. Richard Harris and Chris Joyce, two of NPR's science correspondents. You can find more on global warming at npr.org/climateconnections. And they joined us in Studio 3A. And I'm glad you were able to answer those questions. Coming up, there's karaoke, singing in the shower. And then there's the tribute band. We'll talk about traveling with a Rolling Stones tribute band for a year. It's coming up on Talk of the Nation from NPR News.